From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today marks the 80th anniversary of the execution of Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti for a crime that they possibly did not commit, probably did not commit. The execution took place in Boston, and the entire world was watching, waiting to see if America would really go through with this execution.
Bruce Watson is the author of Sacco and Vanzetti. But first, from 80 years ago to today, immigrant scapegoating. We'll look at the deportation of Elvira Arellano, who took refuge in a Chicago church for more than a year. And we'll look at the triple murder that has rocked Newark, New Jersey, and threatens to divide the Black and Latino communities. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 14 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq after an Army Black Hawk helicopter crashed north of Baghdad this morning. It was the deadliest U.S. helicopter crash in Iraq in over 2.5 years. The cause of the crash is under investigation. Tension continues to grow between the U.S. government and Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. On Tuesday, President Bush refused to publicly support al-Maliki's government. Earlier in the week, Democratic Senator Carl Levin called for al-Maliki's ouster. During a news conference, President Bush was asked about Levin's comment.
There's a process taking place, and the fundamental question is, will the government respond to the demands of the people? And if the government doesn't respond to the demands of the people, they will replace the government. That's up to the Iraqis to make that decision, not American politicians.
Earlier in the day, the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad, Ryan Crocker, warned U.S. support for Maliki's government was not a blind check. Crocker said the level of political progress in Iraq has been, quote, extremely disappointing. President George Bush is scheduled to give a speech today directly comparing the Iraq war to Vietnam. According to excerpts of the speech released on Tuesday, Bush will warn that a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq could produce a catastrophe similar to what occurred in Vietnam and Cambodia after the withdrawal of U.S. troops. In part of the speech, Bush says, quote, the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens whose agonies would add to our vocabulary new terms like boat people, re-education camps, and killing fields. Vietnam historian Stanley Carno told USA Today, Bush is reaching for historical analogies that don't track. He said Vietnam was not a bunch of sectarian groups fighting each other, as in Iraq. In Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge toppled a U.S.-backed government. Carno went on to ask, quote, does he think we should have stayed in Vietnam? The Iraqi Red Crescent Society is reporting the death toll from last week's massive truck bombing near the Syrian border has topped 500 people and left another 1,500 wounded. Doctors say the death toll could rise even higher because 20% of the survivors suffered serious injuries. The double truck bomb was by far the deadliest coordinated attack since the U.S. invasion. The CIA's inspector general has concluded the CIA had no comprehensive strategy for dealing with al-Qaeda before the September 11th attacks and failed to act on information indicating suspected al-Qaeda members had been dispatched to the United States. A newly declassified report released states that the CIA had identified two of the 9/11 hijackers as threats over a year before the attacks. But the CIA failed to rapidly pass their names, Nawaf al-Hamzi and Khalid al-Midar, onto the State Department or to the FBI. The report said between January and March 2000, up to 60 people read CIA cables about how the two men were expected to travel to the United States. It wasn't until late August 2001 that the men were put on watch lists that might have resulted in their capture before the attacks. The Pentagon has announced it'll shut down its controversial domestic spying database known as Talon in mid-September. The Pentagon had used the database to include reports on nonviolent demonstrations and anti-war rallies. The American Civil Liberties Union applauded the decision. Anthony Romero of the ACLU said, quote, there should have been no place in a free democratic society for the military to be accumulating secret data on peaceful demonstrators exercising their First Amendment rights. A summit of North American leaders has concluded in Montebello, Quebec. On Tuesday, President Bush praised NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
And I think we made some good progress toward eliminating barriers and toward harmonizing regulations, to a point where more prosperity will come to be.
Oh, President Bush, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and Mexican President Felipe Calderon met in Montebello to discuss an expanded version of NAFTA known as the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Canadian activist Jaggi Singh said, quote, "The Security and Prosperity Partnership is, in brief, NAFTA on crack combined with the fear and paranoia of homeland security policies." The three leaders also discussed border issues. This is Mexican President Felipe Calderon.
We all want secure borders. We all also want efficient borders, borders that will allow a border crossing of those who build, who contribute, and of course prevent border crossings of those who damage our societies, organized crime, drug trafficking, and illegal markets.
In other news from the Canadian summit, protesters are accusing police of using undercover agents to provoke violent confrontations during the meeting. In economic news, the number of house foreclosure filings reported last month in the United States jumped by 93% from a year ago. There were nearly 180,000 foreclosure filings in July. Nevada, Georgia, Michigan, California, Florida, and Ohio were the hardest hit. The foreclosure rate in Nevada is now three times the national average. Meanwhile, the nation's largest mortgage lender, Countrywide Financial Corp, announced Monday it had eliminated about 500 jobs. 13 pro-democracy activists have been arrested in Burma after participating in a rare public protest. Burma's military junta accused the activists of undermining stability and security of the nation for participating in a series of protests against rising fuel costs and deteriorating living conditions in Burma. The arrested activists included Min Ko Nang and at least six other leaders of a 1988 student-led uprising. Meanwhile, in Bangladesh, police fired tear gas on Tuesday at a group of students demanding that the army withdraw from the campus of Dhaka University. The students took part in the demonstration despite a ban on street protests imposed by the military-backed emergency government. Police injured over 100 students.
They were beaten up and we were absolutely surprised that in the history of Dhaka University, many untoward things happened, but such intervention in the private life and the rights of the students.
The state of Texas is scheduled to carry out today its 400th execution since the state resumed the death penalty in 1982. Johnny Ray Conner is scheduled to be killed for shooting a grocery store clerk. The European Union urged the governor of Texas yesterday to halt all executions before the U.S. state carries out the execution. Meanwhile, a pair of other Texas death row prisoners who are scheduled to die next week have announced plans to stage hunger strikes up until the time of their execution. Kenneth Foster and John Joe Amador said they'll refuse all food beginning Wednesday. The state of Texas is scheduled to execute Amador on August 29th. Foster's execution date is set for August 30th. Both men said they'll commit to a protest of passive non-participation in their executions. In a statement released yesterday, the men said, quote, "We will not walk to our executions and we will not eat last meals. We will not give this process a humane face." Kenneth Foster is scheduled to be executed under a controversial Texas law known as the Law of Parties. The law imposes the death penalty on anybody involved in a crime where a murder occurred. In Foster's case, he was driving a car 11 years ago with three passengers. One of the passengers left the car, got into an altercation and shot a man dead. And the Chinese pro-democracy activist Yang Jianli has returned to the United States after serving a five-year prison sentence in China. Yang moved to Boston after participating in the 1989 Tiananmen Square uprising. On Tuesday, he accused Chinese authorities of torturing him in jail.
The first couple of years of my imprisonment, it was very harsh. When I first got there, there are many worries, and the authorities tried various kind of means to subdue me, try to press for information from me. They used different, so I constantly subject to physical torture and psychological torture.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It was a triple brutal murder that rocked Newark, New Jersey. On August 4th, three college students were killed execution style in an elementary school playground. Police said the three were forced to kneel in front of a wall behind the school and were shot in the back of the head. The three Delaware State University students were 18-year-old Terrence Ariel, 20-year-old Dashon Harvey, and 20-year-old Iofemi Hightower. Ariel's 19-year-old sister, Natasha, also was shot in the back of the head but survived and has helped police identify suspects. Authorities arrested a sixth man on Sunday in connection with the killings. At least four of them are believed to be Latin American immigrants. All have been charged with three counts of murder and one count of attempted murder, in addition to other charges. Larry Hamm is a community organizer in Newark, chair of the People's Organization for Progress. He joins me now in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here, Amy.
Explain what happened first.
Well, it was a terrible tragedy. These young people, four college students, they live in the neighborhood. They went to the school, Mount Vernon School, several of them did. And it was a place that they were familiar with in the neighborhood, the playground in the back of the school, and they were just back there chilling out. Apparently, according to police, six men came in, some individually, some together, confronted the students. The police say it was a robbery gone bad. But there seems to be some controversy around that as to whether it might be gang-related. However, the end result was three of the young people were killed, shot in the back of the head, execution style, and they attempted to kill Natasha Ariel, but she survived and has helped to identify the suspects, according to police.
And how is the community organizing now?
Well,
what are you calling for?
Well, the community has been organizing around this problem of violence in Newark for years. There are a number of anti-violence groups, but we are part of a coalition. The People's Organization for Progress is part of the Peace and Justice Coalition. And we're having a massive march in Newark on Saturday, this Saturday, August 25th, to call for an end to violence, but an end to war. We believe that all the violence should stop, the violence of the war in Iraq and the violence of the war that's going on in our streets.
The weapons that were used?
Well, according to police, it was a gun. And to my knowledge, only one weapon has been discussed.
What about weapons in your community in Newark?
Well, this is part of the problem. See, people have been talking about Newark in the last couple of years, the high homicide rate. But since about 1997, 1998, the murder rate has been pretty consistent. There's been 85 to 100, over 100 murders every year for the last 10 years. And this is being driven by several root causes: abject poverty, astronomical unemployment, and the illegal flow of guns and drugs into our community. But this is not just a Newark problem. This is a national problem. There were more murders in Washington, D.C. last year than there were in Newark. And it's a problem that confronts every urban area in the nation.
I wanted to bring in Republican presidential candidate Tom Tancredo, who denounced Newark's leaders on Monday for providing sanctuary to, quote, illegal aliens. He said, quote, sanctuary cities are safe havens for all illegal aliens, including gang members, drug dealers, rapists and murderers, further exposing law-abiding citizens of such cities to greater crime. This is an excerpt of the speech he delivered in Newark.
The fact that Newark, New Jersey, is a sanctuary city for illegal aliens is well known. In addition, it has been widely reported that two of the alleged perpetrators of the heinous act, which occurred 2 weeks ago Saturday, resulting in the deaths of three young students and the wounding of a fourth, are in this country illegally. Both have prior arrests on charges ranging from sexual assault on a child to robbery and illegal possession of weapons. If the alleged assailants are found guilty of these brutal crimes, Newark and its political leadership share a degree of culpability.
Republican presidential candidate Tom Tancredo, how are you dealing with what could be a big rift between immigrants and African Americans in Newark?
Well, our position is that this issue should not divide the Latino and the African American community. As you know, we have had a history of unity. It was the Black and Puerto Rican Convention in 1970 that led to the election of Ken Gibson. And I think that all progressive leaders in the city are being very careful to urge people not to turn this into a one group, immigrants versus non-immigrants, blacks versus Latinos. This really is an issue of law enforcement, but it's a deeper issue of the problems that confront urban areas. What is happening in Newark today is the direct result of the failure of the development of an urban policy for this country for the last 40 years. I mean, anybody who would read Dr. King would know, even before he died, he was saying that the government had turned its back on the poor, that the war in Vietnam was taking money away from the war on poverty. And that, in essence, has continued. And what we have now is the result of that, cities that are overwhelmed.
Your thoughts, Roberto Lovato, on this. Roberto Lovato also joins us. He's a writer with New American Media, frequent contributor to The Nation magazine, former director of Central American Resource Center in Los Angeles, country's largest immigrant rights group. When you hear Tom Tancredo.
I see business as usual that started back in 94 in California. The extension of the dynamics that gave birth to Proposition 187 there are now national, but they have kind of this new racial and national security bent. And it's, I agree with Mayor Cory Booker, it's troubling, quote, that Tancredo would show up out of the blue and start saying all these things about immigrants when, in fact, studies from Harvard, University of California, Irvine, show that there's immigrants are 45% less likely than U.S. citizens to commit crimes. And so I would ask the question, where is Tom Tancredo when most of the mass murders in the United States have been committed by white people, mostly middle class? Where is the logic, the racial logic behind those mass murders?
I want to segue from this issue to other immigrant issues that have been surfacing now. In another case, immigrant rights agents arrested and deported a Mexican woman who took refuge inside a Chicago church to defy a government deportation order. Elvira Arellano was detained outside a church Sunday in Los Angeles. She'd been living in Chicago's Alberto United Methodist Church for 1 year. Arellano's president of United Latino Family, a group that lobbies for families that could be split by deportation. She was born in Mexico, came to the country as an undocumented immigrant. Her son's Saul was born in the United States and is a U.S. citizen. This is Elvira Arellano speaking from inside the church earlier this year.
I'm very pleased that the help has been so great from our community here in Chicago, as well as across the nation and internationally. This message has gotten out throughout the world, and no matter how humble this place may be, there are families who have been praying for my son and for me, and I feel very content. At times, there are people that say, in truth, negative people, that think I'm in some sort of prison, that not being able to go outside is no sort of life. Who would want to live like that? The truth is, the promise I have made is not with my priest, it is not with my bishop, not with the community. The promise I have made is with God. The house of God is not a prison for anyone, because God is present. I am content, not only because I know that not only will there be a solution for me and my son, but there is going to be a solution for millions of undocumented immigrants that are here in the United States living in the same situation.
That's Elvira Arellano. She was speaking a year ago, took refuge in a Chicago church, recently went to Los Angeles where she was arrested and deported to Tijuana. Roberto, you spoke with her?
Yeah, I met Elvira around the time of that interview, and it's just amazing to see the person that was interviewed on just in that clip and the person I spoke to yesterday. The person I spoke to yesterday was relieved, was inspired, was telling me that she had now been a year in the church and she had time to really reflect on what she had done and had no regrets and was more determined than ever to continue the struggle. And that, you know, her biggest concern is her son. It's always been to be together with her son. And she's giving her son...
Her son Saul's eight.
Her son Saul is eight. And she was concerned about statements people were making that her son was an instrument in her political agenda. And she just said that she wanted to dispel that up front and say, no, my son is like any other child. He's smart. My son is brilliant. My son thinks for himself. I'm giving him the option always. He gave him the option to speak out or not. He spoke out. And she's given him the option whether or not he wants to return to Mexico to be with her. She thinks he eventually will because he wants to be with his mother. He loves his mother. But she's very, very inspiring to talk to.
How does this tie into this issue, the so-called Amigos Summit, Harper, Bush, and Calderon in Canada?
Well, the Amigos Summit, as they're calling it, was primarily about trade and security, continuing the NAFTA agenda and adding kind of a national security component to it. And they believe that, you know, as we're watching immigration mold into a national security issue, the logic coming out of the Amigos Summit is that these guys don't have any control anymore. The sovereignty is a concern in all three countries. In Mexico, people are concerned about U.S. influence. In Canada, people are concerned about U.S. influence. In the United States, you have conservative groups now saying that they're concerned that there's going to be a one currency in the region, that there are rumors of a North American integration. And so immigration and people like Elvira provide, I think, a distraction and an excuse to militarize all three, at least Mexico and the United States, increasingly.
As we wrap up, I want to go to Larry Hamm, but one last question for you, Roberto. You did an interesting piece in Color Lines, the national news magazine on race and politics, called Power from Below. The United States has started resembling another country, one whose nightmares shaped much of my thinking about peace and justice, wartime El Salvador.
Yeah, I just came back from Michoacán, where President Calderón is from, and where Elvira Arellano are from. And it's kind of depressing to see a more militarized Mexico. There are 8,000 troops deployed there right now. And so, you know, at the same time, I was also inspired by the activism. And I think that the activism of the immigrants' rights movement is not dead. I think, in fact, it's kind of the northernmost expression of this continental movement. And I think Elvira's going to Mexico is just the beginning of the very clear transnationalization of the struggle.
Finally, when I read those words of Roberto talking about this country looking like wartime El Salvador, your final thoughts, Larry Hamm, as you're dealing with this mass crisis, this triple murder in Newark?
Well, what happened to those four young people was absolutely terrible, but it's an ongoing problem. There were 60 other young people killed before that. We have to build a movement that addresses these problems. We have to build a people's movement. We're trying to start with that on Saturday in Newark, August 25th at Lincoln Park at 12 noon. We're bringing together all the communities, white, black, Latino, to put together a people's agenda that addresses the problems of our communities. And the fact is that even though we may live in different communities, our problems are interrelated. You cannot divorce what's happening in Latin America, in Iraq, from what's happening on the streets of Newark and Trenton, Los Angeles, and cities all across the country.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Larry Hamm, community organizer, head of People's Organization for Progress. Roberto Lovato, writer with New America Media, frequent contributor to The Nation magazine. We thank you both for being with us. And when we come back from break, we go back 80 years ago to immigrant scapegoating, to the case of Sacco and Vanzetti. They were executed 80 years ago today. Stay with us.
Seminarista, un obrero, con mil papeles de solvencia, que no le dan pa' ser sinceros. Eran las 7 de la mañana, y uno por uno al matadero, pues cada cual tiene su precio, buscando visa para un sueño. Quemándoles la entraña, un formulario de consuelo, con una foto 2x4, que se derrite en el silencio. Eran las 9 de la mañana, Santo Domingo 8 de enero, con la paciencia que se acaba, pues ya no hay visa para un sueño.
Juan Luis Guerra, visa for a dream. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were executed 80 years ago today in Boston, Massachusetts. Sacco and Vanzetti were Italian-American anarchists who were arrested and accused of murder at the height of the post-Bolshevik Revolution, Red Scare, and debates over immigration quotas. After a notoriously prejudiced trial in 1920, they were sentenced to death by a judge who called them, quote, anarchistic bastards. Their execution is infamous around the world and came to symbolize the intolerance and injustice of the American establishment towards immigrants and radical dissenters. Protests against their execution rocked every major city around the world in the days leading up to their execution. Sacco and Vanzetti, The Men, the Murders, and the Judgment of Mankind, is a new book that explores the lives and ideas of these two men and the enduring relevance of their trial. Bruce Watson is author of the new book. I spoke to him yesterday from Boston, where Sacco and Vanzetti were executed 80 years ago, and asked him to talk about the context of the United States in 1920.
It was a very jittery time. It was supposed to be a time of peace, but in fact, 1919 was a year of tumultuous strikes. There had just been a plague flu epidemic that had just ended. Of course, 100,000 soldiers, American soldiers, had died, and it was a very tumultuous year, as I say. And that year, in April of that year, someone, a group of anarchists, mailed a bunch of 30 bombs to the leading capitalists of the day, to John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, several others, anyone who had suppressed anarchists, and only one of the bombs went off. It blew off the hands of a maid who opened it. So the bombs were, about 6 weeks later, the same group decided to deliver those bombs in person. And so at midnight, on June 2nd, 1919, eight bombs in eight cities went off all up and down the East Coast, in churches, in homes. And in fact, one man blew himself up on the steps of the Attorney General's home, the Attorney General of the United States, right across the street from where FDR was living at the time. Well, this set in motion a huge crackdown that later became known as the Palmer Raids, and hundreds of radicals were rounded up and deported. And right after that, as that was waning, Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested. It was right in the edge of that hysteria, and they were tried a year later when some of that was still going on.
Bruce, can you explain who the targets were of this series and the first bombings?
It was anyone who had suppressed anarchists. If you look at a list of the 30 targets, they ranged from senators or former senators to, as I mentioned, Morgan and Rockefeller, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was the later baseball commissioner, but at that time he was a federal judge, and he had presided over a trial that sent a lot of IWW wobblies to jail, other local judges who had ruled against anarchists. So the targets were specifically anarchists. I should mention that the bombs that went off at midnight were found at the site of each bombing a little pink flyer that was signed to the anarchist fighters, and there was a long manifesto that said, you have jailed us, you have beaten us, you have robbed us, now you must know that the vengeance is coming. And I should also not neglect to mention that Sacco and Vanzetti were members of that group, and the people who had perpetrated that, including the man who blew himself up on the steps of the Attorney General's home, were very close friends of Sacco and Vanzetti. They had fled the draft a couple years ago going to Mexico, and down in Mexico, there something went on there with their suffering, and they decided they were ready for vengeance. Now, no one knows to this day what Sacco and Vanzetti did during that bombing, whether they watched it, said nothing, participated, but they were part of that group.
We're talking to Bruce Watson, author of Sacco and Vanzetti. So explain the story of who Sacco and Vanzetti were.
Sacco and Vanzetti came to America independently in 1908, basically to work, for the reason that so many other Italian immigrants came over. Vanzetti had an extra reason. His mother had just died, and he said, I had to put the seas between me and my grief. So he came over, Sacco came over, and they did not have any contact with each other. They didn't know each other until a few weeks before the draft in 1917. They met in an anarchist meeting. They took the same train down to Mexico, and then they came back independently. And then they were in this same anarchist circle in East Boston that met every Sunday through 1919 and then eventually into 1920. And they happened to be together on the night of their arrest, and then, of course, their names are forever linked now.
Where did they come from? Tell the story of where they were born, how they came to the United States, and how they became political.
Okay. I actually went to Italy. I take any excuse I can to go to Italy, but I went back to Italy, to Sacco. They were from very different parts of Italy. Sacco was from a little town called Torre Maggiore in southern Italy, on the tip of near the heel of the boot, and Vanzetti was from a very prosperous northern town near Turin. And so, as I say, they came over for slightly different reasons, but their politicization was somewhat similar. Sacco came over as a real innocent, naive man. He was only 17 when he 15, I think, when he came over. But Vanzetti was a little older. Vanzetti had already started to read different political theories. And both of them, however, began to labor in the American system that was very unfair to Italians at the time. They were on the very bottom of the ladder. They were doing the most menial jobs, Vanzetti in particular. He worked as a dishwasher in a totally slimy kitchen at a very rich restaurant. He worked loading bricks and building dams and just the absolute most menial labor. Spent a lot of time homeless, living on the street. Sacco had a little bit better life. He worked as a shoe trimmer. He took a course and learned an apprenticeship, and learned to be an apprentice shoe trimmer in Boston area, where there are a lot of shoe factories. And he actually made pretty good money. But Vanzetti was not in that situation at all. Both men came to anarchism in around 1912 or 13, and anarchism was a creed at that time widespread among Italian immigrants. You have to remember, these are people who came over and had an American dream. They felt that this was going to be the land of plenty, and they saw quite the opposite. They were discriminated against, they were beaten down, they were denied jobs, cops often arrested them, and they were drawn to this creed of Italian anarchism. Italian anarchists in those days would tour the country and to speak to Italian immigrants, and they would sing. Some of them would sing songs, and they accompanied themselves on the mandolin. They were dodging police. They cut a very romantic figure that appealed to Sacco and Vanzetti and many other immigrants. Anarchism is basically the belief that someday humanity will come to the point where they won't need a government. Italians, of course, had nothing but an oppressive government as far as they could remember, and they couldn't imagine a government of the people, by the people, for the people, that would actually work for the people. All they knew was a government that oppressed and hounded and spied on people, etc. And so they hoped, they dreamed, that someday there would be no government, no need for a government.
And so they come to the United States, and how did they end up both in Massachusetts?
Sacco landed in Massachusetts. He landed with his brother in Boston. They didn't even go through Ellis Island, and began to work in a local Italian community that there are many Italian enclaves. And so he stayed in Boston the whole time. Vanzetti came through Ellis Island and worked in New York for a while, as I say, as a dishwasher and other things. He came up into New England with a friend looking for a job. He worked around in farms and other factories, and eventually settled in Plymouth, Massachusetts, because he could get a job there at a rope factory. He worked loading heavy cords of rope on a loading dock, and he just stuck around because Vanzetti got to know an Italian immigrant family, came to know and love their children very much. He was like a second father to them.
So the night that they were arrested, explain where they were going, how they ended up in the same train, how they knew each other, how Sacco and Vanzetti knew each other.
Well, they knew each other from the Italian anarchist circle that they had been involved in, and that circle was pretty strongly linked. By now, we know they were the ones who had done those midnight bombings. And after the Palmer raids, the police, of course, were hot on the trail of whoever might have done this, and they traced the flyer. By looking at the font on the flyer, they traced it to a printing shop in Brooklyn, and they arrested two men and held them without bail or anything in the 14th floor in New York, on the 14th floor of a federal building. And these are good friends of Sacco and Vanzetti, and the whole anarchist circle was very worried about them and what was going to go on. There was rumors that they were being tortured, and one of the men actually threw himself out the window and was found dead on the sidewalk a couple weeks after the Braintree crime. Vanzetti went down to Brooklyn, or down to New York, to find out anything he could, and he came back about May 1st, 1920, with the word that another raid was imminent. This is according to his testimony in the trial. And they all felt that there was going to be another Palmer raid, another raid rounding up anarchists. And they, according to their testimony, they were out on the night of May 5th. They had gotten a car, a friend with a car. They armed themselves, and they went out to gather radical literature and hide it. And so they went to pick up the car. It had been in the shop. And the police had traced this car. They thought this was the getaway car. They had a reason to believe it was involved in a previous crime, and this was the getaway car. And so they had set a trap. They said, if somebody comes comes to this car, you call us. So these four men, Sacco Vanzetti and two other Italians in their circle, came and got the car, or they tried to get the car, and the woman who was the mechanic's wife called the cops. It was a very dramatic situation. Sacco and Vanzetti and the others, maybe they knew that the phone call was made, maybe they don't. People still debate it, but all of a sudden they said, we're not going to get the car tonight. Never mind, we don't need it. Sacco and Vanzetti were walking back through the darkness. They got on a streetcar. Police got word of that. They pulled a police wagon up in front of the car, boarded the car. Sacco and Vanzetti were alone at the back of the streetcar. You're under arrest. They said, why? Suspicious characters. They took them in for questioning. They, as I said, they did not tell them what they were arrested for. They began to ask them questions about anarchism, about communism. And the man lied and lied and lied. Only the following day, after their mugshots had been taken, rather sinister-looking mugshots, I should add, that were spread across the newspapers all over Massachusetts, only the next day did they learn they were being arrested for murder.
Hmm. We're talking to Bruce Watson, author of Sacco and Vanzetti, The Men, the Murders, and the Judgment of Mankind. So talk then about the trial, about the evidence, about what happened to Sacco and Vanzetti.
The trial took place a full year later because it took their defense lawyer a long time. He was tracking down a man in Italy, a consulate clerk who had gone back to Italy. Sacco's alibi was always that on the day of the crimes, he had been in the North End in Boston, the Italian section, trying to get his passport. And he said, I talked to a clerk, maybe you can find him. And so the clerk they dug up the clerk and found him. And he said, yeah, I remember that guy. So Sacco's defense lawyer was desperately trying to get this man to come to America to testify, but the man was sick and he couldn't come. So there was a delay of a year. Finally, on Memorial Day, or the day after Memorial Day in 1920, the trial began in a fully armed courtroom in a little town that was not at all used to having anarchists in their town. Anarchists, remember, were the terrorists of their times. So an anarchist had assassinated President McKinley, some other world leaders. There had been bombings attributed to anarchists. And so the whole little town of Dedham was terrified of the fact that these anarchists were in their town. And so from the jail, two blocks away, come marching these two guys completely surrounded by police. They march up the steps and into this cage, and the trial begins. And seated at the bench is a man named Judge Webster Thayer, an absolute devout hater of anarchists. He's a super patriot. He has sworn, he said many times, he's desperately afraid of the anarchist doctrine, of the Red Scare and the Red Doctrine. He's sworn that he's going to do anything he can to stop anarchism from taking over. They begin to probe the jury, and it takes them 3 days. They have to grill something like 675 people who are willing to possibly risk their lives because they expect retaliation if there's a guilty verdict. So they finally get the jury seated. And then the trial begins. The prosecution wages an absolutely textbook perfect case. If you want to study a good prosecution, study that prosecution. They bring out the bloody shirts of the guards at first, and everybody gasps. They bring out several witnesses who swear that they identify Sacco, especially at the scene. They took the jurors on a whole tour. They put them in cars and took them to the scene of the crime, took them to several places that have to do with the trial. And then they keep this coming with the defense, with ballistics evidence. They have four bullets they pulled from the guard. They've test-fired the bullets. They had to get Sacco's permission to do this. Sacco said, go ahead, I have nothing to hide. They test-fired the bullets, four bullets pulled from one of the deceased guards. And they say, interestingly enough, one of these four bullets has been linked to Sacco's gun. We have proof that one of them came through Sacco's gun. Now, later, people will ask, wait a second, four bullets pulled out of the guard. A witness says they think they see one guy pumping these bullets in. Only one of them is tied to the guard, tied to the gun. How could that be? But nobody ever asked these questions at the time. They go on with two ballistics experts to identify the bullets. They identify Sacco's gun. They say Vanzetti's gun is the same gun that has been stolen from the guard. Nobody ever saw anybody lift the gun from the guard, but this goes on through. And so finally, the defense comes in, and unfortunately, Sacco and Vanzetti had a rather scattered lawyer. He was a former IWW lawyer, and his name was Fred Moore, and he was brilliant at publicity, but he was very wobbly in court. In addition, his politics were well known to Judge Thayer, and Moore had quote-unquote long hair at the time. He looked a little bit like James Cagney. He had a disturbing habit of taking off his coat, sometimes his shoes in court. Judge Thayer was just shocked by this long-haired anarchist, he called him, from California. Judge Thayer called him Arnicus. He said, no, he out of the trial, he said to press, no long-haired arnicus from California is going to run my court. I'll show him. And so this case, every time Moore speaks up in court, Judge Sayers snaps at him, overrules his objections. Moore waged a very staggered and disjointed defense. He called witness after witness after witness, some 100 witnesses, all of whom swearing Sacco and Vanzetti were not the man. They saw them in Plymouth, saw Vanzetti in Plymouth that day. They saw Sacco in the North End. But by then, the jury seemed to have pretty much made up his mind. Then finally, a key thing happened toward the end of the trial when they called Sacco, first Sacco, and then first Vanzetti, and then Sacco. There was a reason they had to do this. They had to explain, why were they out on that dark night, armed to the teeth? What were they hiding? What were they trying to do? They looked pretty suspicious. The judge had decided they weren't supposed to tell. They said, we're not going to allow politics in this court. We're not trying them for anarchism. But it was actually the defense that said, we have to bring this in. We have to explain. They were anarchists. They were afraid. And so they actually brought up their politics. And then the prosecutor jumped with both feet, and he began grilling Sacco. Do you swear that you love this country? You didn't love this country when you ran away and refused to defend it in Mexico, did you? The only thing you like about this country is that you can make money here. Isn't that the truth? And he grilled Vanzetti about his politics, and this just blew the case wide open. Finally, this was a little bit too much for the jury to take, and they returned, within 5 hours, they returned a guilty verdict.
Bruce Watson, author of Sacco and Vanzetti, The Men, the Murders, and the Judgment of Mankind. When we come back from break, we go to part two of the interview. Stay with us.
Father, yes, I am a prisoner. Of strength and power. Against us is the law. Police know how to make a man a guilty or an innocent. Against us is the power of police. The shameless lies that men have told will evermore be paid in gold. Hatred and the simple fact.
The Ballad of Sacco and Vanzetti, Joan Baez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the interview with Bruce Watson, author of Sacco and Vanzetti, The Men, the Murders, and the Judgment of Mankind. I asked Bruce if the outcome of Sacco and Vanzetti's trial would have been different if their lawyers had used another strategy.
In 1924, Fred Moore finally left the case. He'd done a great job of publicity. He'd also done a very good job digging up doubts about the case. He dug up a lot of dirt, you can only call it, on several of the prosecution witnesses, the identifying witnesses. One turned out to be pretty much a pathological liar. He went to her hometown of Maine and everyone said, you can't trust anything that woman said. And another was basically a con man, a bigamist who hated Italians. And there was all sorts of other things he dug up, too. But by 1924, no one trusted him anymore. In steps a man who I think was the true hero of this whole book, my whole story. He was a corporate lawyer, William Thompson. He was a Boston Brahmin, Harvard Law School graduate, taught at Harvard. He had no reason to take this case. He did not have to take it. He did not agree with Sacco Vanzetti's politics. But he thought, sincerely, they had not gotten a fair trial. And he took the case. I'm sure he lost many clients. He fought it beautifully. He was very eloquent. He argued the case before the Supreme Judicial Court. He defended them brilliantly. They felt if they had had him as their initial lawyer, it would have been very different. They felt that they would not have been convicted.
But the appeal didn't work.
Well, by 1924 and 5, Massachusetts was digging in its heels. The criticisms were starting to come from around the world. People were starting to look at these doubts that Fred Moore had dug up. An interesting thing that happened in 1927 was that Felix Frankfurter, the future Supreme Court justice, who was a Harvard law professor at that time, wrote an article for Atlantic Monthly on the case, calling attention to all of these doubts, the bullet, and there was a cap that was supposed to fit Sacco that really didn't fit Sacco. And there was a confession in 1925. A death row inmate said, I was there. I was in the car. If Sacco and Vanzetti didn't do this job. And they investigated and found some much more likely suspects. And Frankfurter called attention to all of this. But as the criticism came in from all over the world, Massachusetts, a very proud, I dare say, pompous and provincial state at that time, very different than it is now, they began to dig in their heels. And they were not going to accept the idea that a bunch of, as they saw it, radicals around the world could tell the Massachusetts courts what to do. And so the Supreme Judicial Court, when it finally went to their level, they looked at all the evidence, and they simply repeated everything that Judge Thayer had said. They repeated everything that he had said about the cap and the bullets and the guns without even mentioning the doubts. And eventually it became so absurd that when the defense finally got around to filing a motion based on judicial bias, saying this man is biased, Judge Thayer, he called our clients anarchistic bastards. Don't you think that suggests some bias? The Supreme Judicial Court said, okay, we were going to hear that motion. We'll appoint a judge to hear on judicial bias. And the judge that they appointed to rule on Thayer's bias was Judge Thayer. And so you have this absurdity of Judge Thayer sitting in court saying, prejudice? There's never any prejudice. I was not prejudiced. And that went on through. So all of William Thompson's eloquence, all of his forceful arguments, really he was just fighting uphill. And when he finally resigned from the case, when they had appointed a judicial, the governor had appointed a three-man commission with the president of Harvard, the president of MIT, to hear the case, and they finally ruled, basically repeated the same things against Sacco and Vanzetti. William Thompson resigned. He said, the case is remitted to the judgment of mankind.
Hmm. Bruce Watson, what new information did you find in investigating this, well, more than 80-year-old case? It's been 80 years since the execution.
Well, there were many things that I found that they were out there waiting for people to dig up, but the literature of this case and the documentation is so vast that I have to say nobody can do more than dig into this part or that of it, so I can't blame previous authors for not finding this. But a couple curious things that I found. First of all, I found a curious thing about the woman that woman I mentioned earlier who had identified Sacco at the scene of the crime. She fainted during the middle of the court. As testimony, it was very hot in the courtroom, and as she was on the stand for several hours, finally one day she just fainted dead away. Well, I discovered that when Fred Moore, their lawyer, went up to Maine to talk to her son, he just played a hunch. He said, have you ever known your mother to faint? And this 19-year-old kid said, oh, my mother faints all the time whenever anything comes up. And then anything gets hard, she faints dead away. And then she gets up and she talks to you about whatever you were just talking about. So I'm sitting here reading this type of thing. And then there was in 1923, Sacco, who was very nervous, jittery type, was sent to Bridgewater State Mental Hospital. And he was found to be suffering delusions, they called him, of paranoia. Of course, he had pretty good reasons for being paranoid. But I found the transcript of the entire hearing, 3 weeks of private hearings. I sat and read the transcript, and it showed that Judge Thayer thought that Sacco was faking it. Judge Thayer thought he was just trying to, will he escape? And he asked, when he goes to Bridgewater, if he goes to Bridgewater, will there be bars on the cage? Will there be a guard around his door all the time? And William Thompson said, I'd like to thank the judge for making sure this half-starved man will not escape. And then in 1924, an even more suspicious thing came up when someone switched the barrel on Sacco's gun. Now, this was a gun that was linked to the bullet. It's allegedly linked to bullet three, one bullet. The defense had called in a new ballistics expert, supposedly one of the top ballistics experts in America, written up in Scientific American, et cetera, and he wanted to test fire 100 bullets through the gun. And he discovered, as he went and got the gun one day at the courtroom, he looked at it and he said, this barrel looks like it's been cleaned, and it's a little wider than the last time I checked it. And he wasn't quite sure. The gun had been taken apart many times, but he wasn't quite sure it had been switched. He didn't go that far, but he said it looked like it had been, it was a very different barrel. And then the prosecution checked it out, and they said, someone has switched the bullets on this gun. A couple weeks later, they called a hearing. Well, no one had ever discovered this, but there was a transcript of that hearing. And I discovered the entire hearing, which opened up whole new ideas of who might have switched the gun. And there was a moment, a key moment, when Fred Moore, the defense attorney, is approaching the key prosecution ballistics expert. And he's been told that this man knows almost nothing about ballistics, and he's actually reading statistics from a book in his lap. And this is what he's been told. And Moore goes up and he says, aren't you actually, can you tell me, please measure this bullet for me right now. And the man looks at it and he reads out these measurements. And Moore says, aren't you actually reading these from a book that you have in your lap? And didn't you do that during the trial? And the man, all flustered, and he says, no. And he reads out these statistics. But it was fascinating reading to read this transcript. And so that was something else I discovered, and many more things.
Describe the climate and the day that it all took place.
Well, the execution was originally set for July 10th when they were first sentenced, but then Governor Fuller appointed this three-man commission headed by the president of Harvard. They began to look into it. They couldn't start until their academic year was over, so he postponed it to August 10th. When August 10th came, by then Governor Fuller's, the entire nation and the world were waiting the decision a week earlier. On August 3rd, the governor made his decision right around midnight, and it was announced, okay, the whole commission thinks they're guilty. I'm going to go ahead with them. They're going to die on August 10th. On August 10th, the mood in Boston couldn't have been more tense, because there had already been some bombings, subway bombings in New York. There had been bombings in Philadelphia and elsewhere. Anarchists were protesting this. They just couldn't take this lying down. And so there was a tense mood all over Boston and really all across America. There were armed guards at every building, every federal building in America by then, and every subway station in Boston and New York. And as midnight approached, it was thought this would be the time. And so, again, there was just all this in the Defense Committee office in the North End. People were pacing and wondering, are they going to go through with it? Finally, at 11:34 p.m., the governor said, we have an appeal pending. They raced a taxi with the word that they were going to postpone it, raced it to Charlestown Prison. Sacco and Manzetti already had their head shaved. They were ready to go to the chair. They called it off. You can imagine what they must have felt the next morning when they awoke. But they only gave them 12 days reprieve. And in the meantime, there were more bombings when a juror's home was bombed. And by that time, by the night of August 22nd, 80 years ago, there was a sense really in Boston of the inevitable. The city was wrung out. The tension had just exhausted everybody. There had been a knifing. There had been people. A man in Denver had killed himself over the tension of the case. There was the world. There were protests going on all around the world. And there was sort of a sense by then, they're going to go through with it now. There's almost nothing to be done. There were last-minute appeals to Supreme Court judges, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said, this is a state matter. I can't intervene. He thought they didn't quite get a fair deal, but he refused to overrule it. And so it went ahead just after midnight on this night. First Sacco and then Vanzetti were led to the chair and given 2,000 volts and carried out.
Sacco's wife had pleaded with the governor on her knees.
Sacco's wife had pleaded with the governor, and she was with Vanzetti's sister. Vanzetti had never married and didn't have a family, but his sister came all the way from Italy. In the last weeks, the press charted her progress. She marched in Paris with a group. She came up to the port city of Le Havre and came over. The press noted everywhere. She landed in New York. She met a crowd there. She came to Boston. In tears, she met her brother in the jail, and they hadn't seen each other since 1908. And she finally, on that night, the 22nd, she and Rosina Sacco, Sacco's wife, went to the governor and bended knee and pleaded with him. And he basically repeated phrases from his decision, said, I can't, I sympathize with your sorrow, but the Lowell Commission has found the men guilty. And he ignored their pleas, and the execution went on.
And the response around the world?
Shock, sorrow, disbelief. a sense. Catherine Ann Porter, the author, described being outside the jail, and she said life felt grimy and full of shame. And one man heard her, full of disgrace. And one man who heard her said, "What do you mean? There's no such thing as disgrace anymore." And around the world, there were protests, there were riots. The people threw uprooted lampposts in Paris, threw them through plate glass windows. They attacked embassies. The Moulin Rouge was damaged. In Geneva, people took it out on American targets. They targeted stores selling Lucky Strike cigarettes and theaters showing Douglas Fairbanks films. There were strikes all over South America, shut down transportation. The American flag was burned on the steps of the American embassy in Johannesburg. The riots went on. The three people were killed in riots in Germany. The riots went on for a few days, and then finally they stopped in Sacco Manzetti. The funeral in Boston attracted 200,000 people that marched through the streets of Boston to the cemetery where they were cremated.
Bruce Watson, he's the author of Sacco and Vanzetti, The Men, the Murders, and the Judgment of Mankind. I want to end with an excerpt of a feature-length documentary by the same title, Sacco and Vanzetti, directed by Peter Miller, released by First Run Features. This clip explores how Sacco and Vanzetti were politicized, why they became anarchists. It features commentary from opera composer Anton Coppola and historians Nunzio Pernicone and Howard Zinn. It also includes John Turturro as the voice of Bartolomeo Vanzetti, reading from his prison writings.
Most anarchists have a kind of philosophy about what society should be like. And Sacco and Vanzetti subscribed to this philosophy.
We're going to go back to that excerpt of Sacco and Vanzetti. And if you want a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. You can also see the transcript of today's broadcast. Let's go back to Sacco and Vanzetti.
When I came to America, then I saw that people were not living in America, but under America. It meant the bowels of the earth, in the subterranean channels of the social strata. He was translating from the Italian. He's saying, non in America, ma sotto l'America. It sounds very dramatic in Italian, of course. It expresses it in Italian, but if you translate it, it says, not in America, but under America.
He looks upon American society, basically American capitalist society, and says a society that allows this kind of exploitation and poverty should not be able to exist. Sacco came to the conclusion, as did Vanzetti, that the state per se, whether it's a capitalist state or a communist state, is the enemy of freedom and liberty. Consequently, of all the isms available, socialism, syndicalism, anarchism was the ideology which, to Sacco and Vanzetti as well, was the purest, the one which promised the greatest hope of human emancipation. Vanzetti, he had no personal life, he had no wife, he had no girlfriend, and in a sense, he embraces anarchism as if it is, you know, a new focal point, a love interest in his life. He embraces it with a passion and dedication that is truly romantic.
I champion the weak, the poor, the oppressed, the simple, and the persecuted. I maintain that whosoever benefits or hurts a man, benefits or hurts the whole species. I sought my liberty in the liberty of all, my happiness in the happiness of all. I wanted a roof for every family, bread for every mouth, education for every heart, light for every intellect. I am convinced that human history has not yet begun, that we find ourselves in the last period of the prehistoric. I see with the eyes of my soul how the sky is diffused with the rays of the new millennium. Bartolomeo Vanzetti.
Some people think anarchists are just wild-eyed crazy.
That was an excerpt of Sacco and Vanzetti, directed by Peter Miller, released by First Run Features. And that does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shruf Abdokaduse, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Anjali Kamet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carl Mache, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Rebecca Silver, John Randolph. Our website is democracynow.org. There you can get transcripts, our audio, and our video podcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!